From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. During the Israeli incursion into the West Bank, there was a 24-hour curfew that even journalists were expected to observe. But journalist Scott Anderson managed to spend a week with an Israeli commando unit in the West Bank town of Atil. On today's Fresh Air, we speak with Anderson. He wrote the cover story of last week's Sunday New York Times magazine. He's reported from other war zones, including Bosnia, Chechnya, and Sri Lanka. And is the prefix cyber already old-fashioned? Linguist Jeff Nunberg considers how we name online phenomena. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Bush administration acknowledged today there was information about possible hijackings in general before the September 11th attacks, but says there was nothing specific enough to act upon. Several leading senators called for inquiries into government agencies' response to that information. NPR's Andrea Seabrook reports.
Several internal investigations are ongoing, but New Jersey Democrat Robert Torricelli said it would be irresponsible to allow federal agencies to conduct their own reviews.
The Senate should proceed immediately to the establishment of a national commission to reveal to the American people what agencies failed, what was known, what actions were not taken, and most importantly, what can be done to assure that this never happens again.
Legislation that would establish such a commission is scheduled for debate on the Senate floor. It's sponsored by Torricelli and Arizona Republican John McCain, Iowa Republican Chuck Grassley, and Connecticut Democrat Joe Lieberman. Andrea Seabrook, NPR News, the Capitol.
New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg said today that the city will hold a ceremony on May 30th to mark the symbolic end of the recovery and cleanup at the site of the World Trade Center. Even though workers will continue to sift and remove the debris, Bloomberg said the ceremony will be a means to honor the victims and thank the recovery crews. An honor guard will carry an empty flag-draped stretcher from the site to represent victims whose remains have never been found. City officials said the cleanup operation is ahead of schedule and under budget. Palestinian lawmakers are calling for new presidential elections by next spring. An aide to Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat says general elections could come sooner than that, as Arafat presses for reform of the Palestinian Authority. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
Because of travel difficulties, the Palestinian Legislative Council met simultaneously in Ramallah and Gaza City. The lawmakers voted without dissent to hold new presidential elections no later than next April. Arafat yesterday called for sweeping reforms and new elections, although he mentioned no date. Today, one of his advisors told the Associated Press that Arafat would like to see elections within 6 months. The Palestinian Statistics Bureau is struggling to reconstruct current voter rolls. Much of the information was confiscated or destroyed during an Israeli army raid. Those raids have continued almost daily since the end of the recent military offensive. Today, troops killed a Hamas member near Ramallah and arrested Palestinians suspected of plotting bomb attacks in Jerusalem during the Jewish holiday that begins this evening. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Jerusalem.
Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 45 points to close at 10,289 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq Composite Index gained 4 points. It closed at 1,730. The S&P 500 gained 7. This is NPR News. Firefighters are working to contain a wildfire that's destroyed 7 homes on the edge of Prescott, Arizona. Officials said the 700-acre blaze has forced about 1,500 people to leave their homes. As many as 2,000 houses could be threatened by the fire, which has been spread by gusty winds. In Birmingham, Alabama today, a former Klansman's ex-wife testified that he told her that he placed the bomb that killed 4 black girls in 1963. NPR's Debbie Elliott reports.
Willadine Brogdon was married to Bobby Frank Cherry in the early 1970s. She took the witness stand today for the state in Cherry's murder trial in the 1963 bombing of Birmingham's 16th Street Baptist Church. Brogdon testified that Cherry's car broke down about a block from the church, and she went to go get him in 1970. She said Cherry pointed to the church and said that it was where he put a bomb under the steps. Brogdon testified that on several occasions, Cherry talked about how he lit the fuse to the bomb. She said he would sometimes get upset and say he regretted that children were killed, but at least, quote, they couldn't grow up to be more niggers. On cross-examination, Cherry's lawyers tried to point out inconsistencies in her account today and what she previously told a grand jury. Debbie Elliott, NPR News, Birmingham.
Housing construction slowed in April, declining for the second month in a row. The Commerce Department said new housing starts fell by more than 5% from March, which was already down more than 8% from the month before. Housing starts fell the most in the Northeast and the Midwest. New construction actually rose by more than 5% in the South. Analysts have said that last year's surge in housing construction was too strong to be sustained. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo, providing innovative approaches to food and facilities management services throughout North America. On the web at SodexoUSA.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. During the Israeli incursion into the West Bank, known as Operation Defensive Shield, which began in late March, there was a 24-hour curfew, and even journalists who were spotted outside were fired on by Israeli military. Yet my guest, journalist Scott Anderson, managed to spend the second week of the incursion traveling with a platoon of elite Israeli commandos in the West Bank town of Atil. His report was the cover story of last Sunday's New York Times Magazine. Anderson also spent time with Palestinians in Ramallah after the Israeli offensive and in Bethlehem before and after. Anderson has reported from several war zones, including Bosnia and Chechnya. He's the author of several books about war zones and is a frequent contributor to the New York Times Magazine. I asked him to describe the Israeli commando unit that he traveled with.
I was with a platoon of elite commando reservists. These were men who, during their compulsory training from the ages of 18 to 21, had been chosen to form a kind of the Israeli equivalent of our American special forces. With the reserve system in Israel, these men are called up periodically, usually about a month out of every year. So the unit I was with, they range in age from 22, they had just come out of compulsory service, all the way up to the early 40s. So it was a 125-man unit, and spanning 25 years in age and a wide range of occupations.
What was their mission?
This unit's particular mission was to operate in and around the West Bank city of Tulkarm. Tulkarm has a reputation of being a real center of Palestinian militancy. Quite a few suicide bombers have come out of there, including the suicide bomber who did the Park Hotel bombing in Netanya that was the final spark to the Israeli offensive. Their mission was to go in as a vanguard before the regular army into Tulkarm to seize the choke points around the town. And then once Tulkarm was secured, which took place very quickly, it was in the first day of the offensive, this unit then was operating, going into Tulkarm and the surrounding villages to try to grab Palestinian militants who were wanted by the security forces.
And how are they supposed to find them?
They have a real array of intelligence. They do aerial surveillance from planes. They have human intelligence from collaborators, and also they have a system in the Israeli army of soldiers who go into the West Bank disguised as Palestinians and often will spend months, even years, living within the community and watching who the leaders are. So it was on the basis of that they identified who they felt were the leaders of the extremists within the Tulkarm area. The problem once the offensive got started is that there was a real prelude to the offensive. So a lot of most of the people they were looking for had gone into hiding.
The Israeli commandos that you were traveling with established a base in a Palestinian home at the edge of town. Can you describe how that process works, why they do that, how they choose which home to take over, how they take it over?
Mm-hmm. The first thing I should say is that all these towns were under a blanket curfew. And blanket curfew means 24 hours a day, people are inside their homes. They're not allowed out. what the Israelis were doing periodically, usually about every third or fourth day, was opening the curfew for about 3 hours just to let people go out and get food and stuff. So when you come into these villages, it's like coming into a ghost town. You don't see anyone on the streets. What the Israeli army does is they have this policy of when they're going into a town like this, they want to be able to be in a command position where they can see what's going on in the town. The only way to do that, in their view, is to take over a house. And what they tend to do is to take over a house that's quite spacious because they need room for a lot of soldiers, that has a commanding view of the surroundings, so usually a two- or three-story building. And ideally, that there's not a lot of other houses around it because they want to have a kind of a secure perimeter, room for their armored personnel carriers to be out front and occasionally tanks. So they tend to seize houses from the wealthy or the upper middle class. The particular house I was in, we had first been in a wedding banquet hall at the edge of this town of Atil, and after 2 days, it was clear that it wasn't a very secure location. There were a lot of other buildings that had a view into it, and so they started looking around for a new command post. And they found a house on the other side of the village, 3-story house. I wasn't there when the first scouting party decided to choose this house, but the way it works is they literally just come up, knock on the door, the family answers, and they ask to see the house, the Israelis. They walk through, and if they decide that it's a secure location and there's enough room, they tell the Palestinian family to leave. Usually for 2, 3, 4 days. So rarely much longer than that, because again, these sorts of units, these kind of commando units, don't like to stay in one place for very long. Sometimes they will just move the Palestinian family into one corner of the home. That wasn't the case with the unit I was with. They forced the family to just leave. They usually give them a half hour, an hour to gather up whatever they want to take, and then they just go.
So the Israeli commandos are using this house as their base. It's a 24-hour curfew, aside from these 3 hours every few days in which Palestinians are allowed out. So every time they see a Palestinian, the Palestinian is a suspect immediately because they've broken the curfew.
That's right.
You give a very good example in your piece. There was a Palestinian family, a whole family, that went up on a rooftop.
Right.
I think this was at night?
No, that was during the day.
It was during the day.
What happened in this one incident? We were in the Palestinian house on the edge of Atil, and about 300 yards away at a house, a Palestinian family came out on their rooftop, breaking curfew even by going out on your roof. Within the house, it's a very strange existence because all the curtains are drawn. You have snipers throughout the house watching the surrounding buildings, the surrounding roofs. So one of the snipers saw this family come out on the roof, and because they were too far away to shout at them, they couldn't do a warning shout, this sniper fired a warning shot at them. And probably the first shot was about 20 feet away from them. The family didn't respond. He kept firing closer and closer to them. Ended up firing, I believe, 7 times until he shot out their rooftop water tank and their satellite dish. He winged the top end of the satellite dish. And it was very clear at a certain point, probably after about the second or third shot, that the family knew that the warning shots were being fired at them. It was very clear that they knew it was directed at them, but it was this kind of act of defiance and just of resistance to show in any way they could. And then finally that family went back inside. But what was happening periodically in both in this first wedding hall that we were in and then the Palestinian house was that people on the street, usually teenage boys or men in their 20s, would break curfew and approach the house. And this was usually almost always would happen during the daytime. And it was this kind of taunting, testing thing of approaching the house, getting the Israeli soldiers to fire warning shots at them. And on the one hand, it could have just been this kind of act of defiance. But what made the Israelis very nervous is that that's also sort of a classic technique for if there's a sniper on the other side, to figure out where the Israelis are in the house, you know, which windows they're hanging out in. So it's in the
past, to intentionally draw fire.
Right, and so that then there, a gunman in the background who's watching the house can see which windows the Israeli soldiers are shooting from, mm-hmm. and then try to pick one of them off.
Did you speak to Israeli commandos who fired at Palestinians approaching the house, or who fired the warning shots at the family on the rooftop, and talk with them about their attitude toward firing at the Palestinians?
Yes, I did talk with them. Among this platoon of 125 men, it's composed of many smaller units who are periodically going off on raids, and sometimes you wouldn't see them for 2 or 3 days. So the group I ended up being with was the kind of the headquarters unit, and it was this hardcore of about 25 men. I talked to them quite a bit about that, and two things sort of came across in my conversations with them, and it was the fascinating thing was that it spanned the political spectrum among these guys. Some of these guys were quite left wing, others were quite right wing, and the two quandaries that everybody talked about were first the military quandary, and second kind of a moral quandary, and the military quandary being, how do you fight a war like this, you know, looking for certain specific people among a civilian population, where that civilian population pretty much universally despises you, doesn't want you there, sees you as occupiers. And the problem they face on the military side is that every tactic they use to try to look for these men inside, you know, inside the West Bank, inside the occupied territories, whether it's taking over Palestinian homes or operating checkpoints or doing raids on houses at night, each of them have the ultimate effect of inflaming the Palestinian population that much more. One thing they're having to do at checkpoints, the Israeli army does at checkpoints now, is any male between the ages of 15, probably even younger now, to 50, they're forced to lift their shirt and then lower their trousers to show that they're not wired with a suicide bomb. Now, from the Israeli standpoint, they see this as just necessary in the age of the suicide bomber. Of course, to the Palestinians, they see this as a tactic of humiliation. And there's a recurrent pattern of the tactics that the Israelis use, which they feel completely justified in using, but have the effect of just inflaming the local population that much more.
My guest is journalist Scott Anderson. We'll talk more about traveling with a platoon of Israeli commandos during the military offensive in the West Bank after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is journalist Scott Anderson. He's reported from many war zones. From March 24th through the end of April, he was in the Middle East. During the second week of April, he traveled with a group of Israeli commandos as they tried to root out Palestinian militants who were on the Israel military's wanted list. You've told us a little bit about what it was like when the Israeli commandos saw Palestinians who had broken the curfew. One day you went with them as they raided a house that they believed to be the hiding place of a local commander of the military wing of Fatah, Arafat's party. Why did they suspect that a local commander was in this house?
I wasn't privy to why they targeted this house in particular. I gathered that it was from intelligence they'd gathered out of the village, probably from aerial surveillance also. And the thing about this platoon is that almost all their operations, because they're behind, you know, they're in hostile territory, virtually all their operations are done at night. So this raid on this house was done at about probably about 2:30 in the morning, and we approached the house from about a half mile away. We came up in armored personnel carriers and then hiked in to the village. The soldiers surrounded the house and banged on the door. A man came to the door, and it turned out that it wasn't the man they were looking for, but it was his brother. So it clearly was a house that was in the family. It's a very tense situation because on the one, you have one whole group of soldiers who are surrounding the house that's being raided, but you have another whole ring of soldiers outside watching all the surrounding houses for a sniper to appear. And they want to do these operations as quickly as possible, but also as thoroughly as possible. So what happened was they had the man in the house bring out his family, and his family was his wife and his mother and seven or eight young children, and they brought them out and they stood them out on the terrace of the house. They used the father, the man of the house. They put him in front and made him walk first into the house. They were going to search the house, but first in Arabic, the deputy platoon commander said, "Everybody's out of the house." The father said yes, and the platoon commander said, "Because you understand, if there's anyone in the house, we're going to shoot them." The father said, "Yeah, no, everyone's out." So with the father leading the way into the house, the soldiers just went room to room at gunpoint. You know, their guns raised and poised to fire, searching for the man that they were looking for. About the fourth room, they approached, and the house was all dark. The deputy platoon commander, who was in the lead right behind the father, all of a sudden sees this shadow moving in the room, and he, rather than fire, he just hesitates a split second. He moves up against a wall and draws a bead on the figure moving in the dark, and he hesitates long enough to realize it's a boy of about 8 or 9. Apparently, the father forgot. Despite being asked repeatedly, that he'd forgot that there was still one, a kid inside the house. And to me, what was amazing about that incident, I've been with other military units around the world, and in any other situation where I've been in like that, with another military, that kid would have been absolutely killed, including with the American military. That kid was just would have been killed. These commandos were so well trained, and the soldier in particular who was the lead coming into this room, just hesitated for a split second, and probably against his own training in a way. I mean, when you're a soldier and you get into a situation where you perceive danger, your first response is to fire, but by not doing so, of course, like averted a kind of a tragedy. So I was very impressed by the particular platoon I was with. These guys were incredibly cool and very level-headed. Do they exemplify all of the Israeli army? No, I don't think so. I mean, these guys were extremely well trained.
What was the father's reaction when he realized that one of his sons was still in the house and that he'd left his son in enormous jeopardy?
Well, there was a moment of sort of panic, and the soldiers were shouting at him, and they grabbed the kid and sort of thrust him in his father's arms, and told him get him out of the house. The interesting thing was I talked with the soldier who was outside guarding the family, outside of the house. All the children and the mother and the wife had all been kept out on the porch, and he had been keeping all these kids at gunpoint throughout this whole search, and the search went on for about a half hour. And this man was a father himself. He has two young children, and he said, the thing that was just so strange, here it is, these kids, some of them are 4 and 5 years old. They've got a soldier with a gun pointed at them, and they just weren't scared at all. They were at times they were joking, they were giggling. It was just like no big deal to them. And the soldier, whose name was Yaniv, he said to me, I was imagining my own children in that situation, and they would have been petrified. They would have been crying. And for these kids, it was just like, it's like no big deal. And even when the boy came out and joined the rest of the family, they were sort of joking about it. They were kind of laughing at like, how could you be so stupid as to sleep through this, or And what Yaniv, the soldier, saw was just the gulf of experience between, you know, what's happening in Israel and what's happening in among the Palestinians. The Palestinians are just not intimidated.
Mm-hmm. What was it like when the Israeli commandos gave up the house that they had occupied to use as their headquarters?
It's kind of funny. They take it almost it's a very kind of quirky pride. And again, it's this particular unit because, you know, certainly there were cases, in well-documented cases in during this offensive where Israeli units went into houses and just completely trashed them. This unit, they were under strict orders. You do not touch anything of the families. You don't use their soap. You don't go into the refrigerator. You don't even take, you know, bottled water. You don't use anything of theirs. Everything we ate, everything we drank was stuff that we brought in the armored personnel carriers. And when they leave houses, some of the last soldiers out of the house, they actually clean it. I mean, they find the vacuum cleaner or the mop, and they, as much as possible, kind of tidy up the place. I mean, no matter how gentle they treat it, you have anywhere from 25 to 45 soldiers with their equipment trooping in and out of a house at all hours for several days. There is going to be some damage. But the interesting thing in this house we were in is that there was a framed photograph of the patriarch of the family, a man in his probably 60s or early 70s, and in one corner of the frame was a smaller picture of a boy, presumably this man's grandson, a boy wearing a Palestinian Mujahideen uniform and clutching a toy Kalashnikov. And this rule of not touching anything was taken to a degree that the Israeli soldiers would look at this photo, and they'd shake their heads. But no one touched the photo. No one destroyed it. It just stayed there during the whole time we were there.
Scott Anderson. We'll talk more in the second half of the show. Anderson's article about traveling with a platoon of Israeli commandos during the military offensive in the West Bank was the cover story of last Sunday's New York Times Magazine. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of With These Hands, a collection of stories by Louis L'Amour, author of May There Be a Road. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more with journalist Scott Anderson about traveling with a platoon of Israeli commandos in the West Bank. Also, linguist Jeff Nunberg on creating the language for things that exist only on the Internet. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with journalist Scott Anderson. During the second week of Israel's incursion into the West Bank, known as Operation Defensive Shield, Anderson traveled with a platoon of Israeli commandos in the West Bank town of Atil. The platoon's mission was to locate and capture key leaders of Palestinian militias. His article about the platoon was the cover story of last Sunday's New York Times Magazine. Anderson also spent time with Palestinians in Ramallah after the incursion and in Bethlehem before and after. Did the Israeli commandos that you traveled with ever accomplish a part of their mission in the week that you were with them?
During the week I was with them, they didn't grab any of the people that they were that were on their target list. They did catch a couple of men on these what they call ambushes. They'll send small units out and lay beside a road up to a day, up to 24 hours, and they did manage to catch a couple of men coming down this road who were wanted, but rather low level. Before I joined them in the initial push into Tul Karm and in the surrounding area, they had managed to get I believe three or four fairly high level people they were looking for, and all told in the operation they got about 20 people who were on their target list, but the majority of people they were looking for had either moved into the interior or gone up and were hiding in caves up in the hills, or had just had hiding places within Tul Karm or the surrounding villages. It really resembled a very expensive and very dangerous police operation. Ultimately, all movements done in armored personnel carriers, everything done at gunpoint, living inside these seized houses with the lights out because you were worried about sniper fire coming in. At least with this particular unit and what they were doing, it was this odd thing of an offensive being carried out in this state of sensory deprivation.
The Israeli commandos that you traveled with ranged in age from their 20s to through their 40s because they're reservists. And they also had a wide range of opinion politically about the incursion, about the future of Israel and the Palestinians. Can you just give us a sense of the two extremes that you heard among the commandos?
Mm-hmm. Well, from the left to the right, I would say the left, very much mirroring the left of Israeli society, they feel that the solution to the problem is a return to the 67 borders and a Palestinian state. On the right, there was a feeling of that the only thing the Palestinians understand is force, that first we need to sort of crush them, to use the words of Ariel Sharon, and then talk peace. The interesting aspect of this call-up for this offensive was that everybody, from the left to the right, felt that this offensive was necessary at this time because there had just been so many suicide bombings, as so many people had been killed, that something had to be done. And among the leftists, the feeling was, even if this isn't the right thing, even if it has the effect of pushing peace further away, we have to do something. So there really was this, I wouldn't say, support for the offensive in the short term. But on the at the same time, looking at the kind of end game, what was remarkable was that among both the left and the right, there was this universal, among the soldiers I was with, this universal feeling that this offensive was not really going to solve anything, that it certainly wasn't going to militarily destroy the what the government calls the terrorist infrastructure, that the only way out in the future is for a negotiated settlement and for a Palestinian state. Now, there was a lot of disagreement of what that Palestinian state would actually look like, whether it includes the settlements and what happens at Jerusalem. But it was really astonishing to me to see that even among the soldiers who called themselves right wing, there was this acceptance that the only way out of the situation was an independent Palestinian state. And in some ways, I feel that this platoon I was with, they were a military vanguard, but I think in a certain way they're also almost a political vanguard of Israel, because I think they're ahead of the curve in Israeli public opinion of how you go forward. They're the guys who are out there facing, risking their lives each day and facing a Palestinian population. And I think they have a much better sense of what Israel is up against than people sitting in Tel Aviv and saying, oh, you know, we should do this, we should do that.
What were the reactions to the possibility of having to go back, you know, in another 6 months or a year and do another incursion into the territories if this isn't effective or if negotiations don't really happen in the next few months?
Again, and looking at the sort of political spectrum of this unit, I would say that among the rightists, there was this feeling of like, well, you know, if we get called up again, we'll have to come back. Among the leftists, there a lot of whom had deeply grappled with the issue of showing up this time. For moral reasons, they feel they shouldn't be in the West Bank. A lot of men on the kind of the peacenik side of Israeli society that I talked to, this had been a real struggle for them to come back this time. And what several of them said to me was, you know, what we're doing with this offensive is we are creating this hopefully creating this peaceful space for the leaders of both sides to talk. And if they waste that space that we're creating, we're not going to come back. You know, if we feel that, you know, we're being used in lieu of any sort of political or diplomatic progress, and if our government is just using us to, like, periodically, you know, throw us against the other side, you know, we're not going to put up with it.
How did you get to travel with the Israel military? They don't strike me as being that open to press coverage.
No. Well, in fact, I was the only journalist who was able to travel with them during this offensive.
This is a period when Israeli military men were actually firing on journalists.
Yes. Well, I think it was a matter of good timing. I had gotten to Israel. I had been working on this story for a while. I had been fascinated for several months now of what was happening within the Israeli military, because as you've throughout this winter and the spring, as the situation in Israel was deteriorating, it seemed that the political parties were very much hardening on both sides. And I was curious what was going on with the Israeli reservists, who are actually being put out in these situations where, you know, the Israeli army has always prided itself on being one of the best armies in the world. But what they've all of a sudden started to face with the Palestinians in the last year is an actual, growingly formidable fighting force. More and more reservists have been killed at checkpoints. There have been several times their armored personnel carriers have been blown up and a lot of soldiers killed. And I was curious, going back in February and March, of, from a military standpoint, what are these men now thinking? That, you know, do they now feel that they're getting into a situation where militarily they can't control it anymore? So I had approached the Israeli army, I think back in February, about this idea of going in and spending some time with a reserve unit near the front. And it had been somewhat set up. And then when I got to Israel, then, of course, everything blew up. And my getting out in the field with these guys got delayed a little bit. But it just took a lot of pressing. And finally, they put me with a unit.
My guest is journalist Scott Anderson. We'll talk more about traveling with a platoon of Israeli commandos during the military offensive in the West Bank after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is journalist Scott Anderson. In April, during the second week of Israel's military offensive in the West Bank, Anderson traveled with a platoon of Israeli commandos in the West Bank town of Atil. His report was the cover story of last Sunday's New York Times Magazine. Were you able to spend much time with Palestinians, not with the Israeli army, but just seeing what what the Palestinian experience was like during the incursion.
Yes, immediately before I was with the commandos, I was based in Jerusalem for the first week of the offensive, and made several trips into Bethlehem, tried to get into Ramallah, and then when I had left being in the field with the commandos, I was back in Jerusalem, and at that point the offensive was winding down a little bit, or it was easier to move around. There weren't as many Israeli army checkpoints around, so I was went back into both into Bethlehem and Ramallah.
Now, I know you went to the home of a 15-year-old boy who had killed himself in a suicide bomb the day before. What did his family and neighbors have to say about the suicide bombing?
Well, to me, this is the real fiction that the Israeli government, the Sharon government, has. They're going to have to open up to. You know, the whole idea of this offensive is to smash the infrastructure of terrorism, in Ariel Sharon's words. When I went to this house of this boy who'd killed himself the day before, and I'm sorry, I can't remember the exact date it happened, because there was a suicide bombing every day around Jerusalem in late March, and so they kind of blend together. But it was a 15-year-old boy who had walked up to an ambulance office in the outskirts, right near Jerusalem, and had blown himself up. And he had wounded, I believe it was 6 medics. He didn't kill anyone. He killed himself. I went to his house the next day, and the father was sort of holding court out in front of the house. The women were in another house. The mourning was done separately among Palestinians. The neighbors, friends, family were all kind of coming up and congratulating the man on the martyrdom of his son. I talked with a next door neighbor of this house, and the man I was talking to, he had a 15-year-old son who was a classmate of the boy who'd killed himself. And this man, who was educated, I believe he was an engineer, said, "You know, I'm really opposed to the suicide bombings, and I've told my son this so many times, but I have no idea of what's going on inside his head now. There's so much rage and despair among the children that would it surprise me if my own son became what they call a shaheed, a martyr?" And he said, "No, it wouldn't surprise me." And what is happening and again, going back to this idea that this fiction of an infrastructure of terror. The way the suicide bombings are being done now is literally high school kids, and not just boys now, girls, deciding they want to be martyrs and going up to the village square. And in the village square in Palestinian towns, the Tanzim militia guys hang out there, the Hamas guys hang out. And it's a matter of going up and talking to these to the militants and saying, "You know, I want to be a martyr. Can I get a belt?" And of sort of being chosen. It's a very informal process. And another thing about these belts is it's 500 shekels to make a suicide belt, which is about $120. So, you know, the Israeli government was talking throughout this offensive of how many suicide belts they'd captured. Well, you know, if a suicide belt costs $120 to make, it doesn't really matter how many you capture, because they can very quickly be replaced. So I think the really horrifying thing from the Israeli standpoint that they're facing is that there is just not much infrastructure of terror to break. It is, and as one of the soldiers I was with said, you know, the infrastructure is now in the minds of the teenagers. And, you know, how do you fight that? And I'm not sure there is any way to.
You told us that there was a lot of political diversity among the Israeli commandos that you traveled with. Left, right, center were all represented. What about among the Palestinians you spoke to? Was there a lot of political diversity there?
I would say less so. I think that there's much more of a unanimity of feeling among the Palestinians that it's time for them to have their own state and it's time for the Israelis to leave. There's a political diversity among, ranging of the tactics of how you get there, you know, from the extreme of we have to do it through bleeding the Israelis and with suicide bombings to the other end of the spectrum of, you know, we need to do it through peaceful means. But that end of the spectrum of approaching it from peaceful means, I think, is getting smaller and smaller all the time among the Palestinians.
After having traveled, after having spoken both with Israeli military commandos and with Palestinians, did you see attempts on either side to really understand, humanize, find some empathy for the other side?
Somewhat. You know, these are both very sophisticated cultures. So yes, I mean, I think there will always be this sort of element of the society that tries to bridge the gulfs between the two people. But I have to say, at this particular time, the overwhelming sentiment that I felt on both sides was just the opposite, more of a demonizing sentiment that was going on, which often happens in a war situation. You demonize and you dehumanize the enemy, and I think both sides are doing that right now. And unfortunately, I think a lot of it is coming from even the governmental level. So,
did you get a sense that Israelis and Palestinians were hating the policies or the policies and the people? In other words, were the people themselves being demonized, or is it just the policies?
You know, it's an interesting question, because it's very hard. What I found was this: I think these two peoples are actually, they have an awful lot in common, and a lot of people, both Israelis and Palestinians, will say that. You know, their cultures are quite similar, and even linguistically, they have a lot of words in common. But you know, and they've been living amongst each other for a very long time. So there is this element of almost a shared history. Against that, though, is, you know, the level of violence on both sides has gotten so severe, I think, on both sides, and especially maybe the less educated on both sides. There is this feeling of looking at the other side as just bloodthirsty monsters. But going to this idea of this sort of shared culture or shared view on things, I was thinking when I was there, and especially during this one week where there was a suicide bombing every day, and I was thinking what would happen in the United States if that had been the case, and if there had been, say, a particular ethnic group or a religious group who were doing these suicide bombings. And I think that in this country, you would have very, very quickly seen vigilantes going after this group. I think you would have seen a lot of violence against the group, just sort of generalized violence. That didn't happen in Israel. And I think that there, because these two societies really are so intermingled, among most people, there's not this tendency to lump everybody in as one, because they have like daily connections with them, which also, of course, perversely, and everything in Israel is ultimately perverse, it makes it that much harder to see how you ever separate it. You know, there's now this talk of actually just putting up a wall and separating the two peoples. But these two cultures are so intertwined at this point, I don't know how you ever really achieve a separation. So, and if you don't have a full separation, then you're always vulnerable to attacks from one side to the other.
Did you find yourself trying to do the moral calculus of both sides and see which side could take the moral high ground in terms of living under occupation or living with suicide bombing?
Yeah, I did. I think I think everybody does when they first get to Israel. You know, the awful thing, and I think even Israelis would admit this, the awful thing is that terrorism, and if you want to call suicide bombing, I think most people would agree that suicide bombings are a form of terrorism. Terrorism can often work, and I think maybe not to what you want at the end game, but at a certain point it works. And it's this awful reality is that because so many Israelis have been killed by suicide bombs, especially in the last 4 or 5 months, it really has propelled. It provoked the military offensive by the Israelis, but it really has helped bring about a change in the Palestinian status in the world. And I mentioned earlier this you know, what I was really amazed by among Israelis was the lack of talk now about the creation of the Greater Israel, of just annexing the West Bank and kicking the Palestinians out and making the whole thing part of Israel. And I believe that that change in Israeli public opinion has come about because so many of them have been killed. They realize that they are against an implacable enemy, and they know now that the price of not making a deal with the Palestinians, it's no longer facing rock throwers and Molotov cocktails and the occasional drive-by shooting. It's these suicide bombings where 25, 30 people are killed in the blink of an eye. And that's not going to change. If anything, it's just going to get worse.
Scott Anderson, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Scott Anderson's article about traveling with a platoon of Israeli commandos was the cover story of last Sunday's New York Times Magazine. Coming up, linguist Jeff Nunberg on creating names for things that exist only online. This is Fresh Air. A couple of months ago, our linguist Jeff Nunberg did a piece on blogs. That's short for web logs, websites where people record daily comments and link to other sites. Some people aren't happy with that word, but Jeff says it's the wave of the future, the way we will name things in the digital world.
Shortly after my piece on blogs ran, I got an email from somebody who objected to my use of the word, particularly when it's used to describe the records that people post on the web of their daily thoughts and doings. I should have called them e-journals, she said. I could see her point, but blog is a syllable whose time has come. Who can resist that Paleolithic pizzazz? It's the tone you hear in a lot of programmer jargon, in words like kludge, mung, and scrog. That's how insiders demystify the technology. It sets them apart from the digital parvenus who laid their speech with technical-sounding language. When we use blog, it's as if to say we're all geeks now. Anyway, it's gotten old, the whole business of naming online phenomena by tacking a qualifier onto the name of some pre-digital category. First there was cyber, which had its efflorescence in the first half of the 90s. Those were the salad days of cyberspace, not the noirish locale that William Gibson had in mind when he coined the word, but more like something out of C.S. Lewis, an enchanted kingdom on the other side of the screen where everything and everyone has an ethereal cyber counterpart. Cybercrime and cyber police, cyber poetry and cyber novels, cyber pets and cyber hippies. Cyber connoted a place that was freed from the trammels of materiality and distance, where people would slip on new identities as easily as they changed their shirt. You think of the caption on that widely reprinted cartoon that Peter Steiner did in The New Yorker back in 1993, "On the internet, nobody knows you're a dog." By the mid-90s, though, that cyber talk was sounding hopelessly naive. The net was becoming crowded, noisy, and above all, lucrative. And it was turning out to be anything but anonymous. It was more like, on the internet, everybody knows what brand of dog food you buy. After 1996, the word cyberspace became less frequent in the press, the gold rush was on, and people migrated to the new prefix E, which seems to have been short for El Dorado. The E prefix had a promising beginning. In 1998, the American Dialect Society voted it the new word that was most likely to succeed. Like a lot of the predictions that people were making back then, that one would turn out to be over-optimistic just 2 years later. When you track the frequency of E in the press, in fact, its fortunes almost exactly parallel the NASDAQ index. By 2001, it was 60% off its peak. And E isn't likely to make a comeback even when the tech sector reemerges, no more than most of the companies whose names begin with it. It'll stick around in e-commerce and, of course, email, the way cyber is still around in a few words like cyber sex, maybe the last thing in digital life that has a touch of intrigue to it. But we've left off thinking of the online world as a remote or separate place. For the time being, at least, the new economy is going to be just a neighborhood of the old, and one with a higher vacancy rate at that. Anyway, a lot of those distinctions were always unnecessary. What was the idea behind the words cyber essay and cyber poetry? Are essays and poetry really transformed once you no longer have to send them to the printer? Ditto e-statements and e-bills, not to mention all the increasingly desperate names that were coined with I and K as companies started to switch prefixes as rapidly as they were switching business plans. For that matter, what's the point of virtual bait shop so long as the crawlers are real? Of course, a lot of the things that have emerged online are genuinely novel, but then why strain to find their offline counterparts? That's the beauty of blog. You could call these things virtual journals, e-clipping services, or cyber Christmas letters. But why can't they just be unique in all their bloggy essence? We go through this every time a new technology emerges. It took a while before people could stop talking about horseless carriages, electric iceboxes, and electronic brains. But in the end, those hybrid names always wind up sounding quaint. And so will all those compounds with cyber, e, virtual, and the rest. If we were smart, we'd drag them all to the trash icon of history right now. But that isn't likely to happen. They'll end their days attached to useless computer accessories and get-rich-quick schemes, the same way the suffix "-omatic" migrated from the names of all those proud post-war Fords and Buicks to the tacky gadgets they sell on late-night TV.
Jeff Nunberg is a researcher at Stanford's Center for the Study of Language and Information, and he's the author of the book The Way We Talk Now. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today is Roberta Shirok. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. Today is the 36th anniversary of the release of the Beach Boys album Pet Sounds. We'll close with an outtake from the album's song God Only Knows.
If you should ever leave me, the life would still go on, believe me. The world could show nothing to me. So what good would living do me? God only knows what I'd be without you. God only knows what I'd be. What I'd be without you.
God only knows what I'd be without you.
God only knows what I'd be without you.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Nick Hornby discusses his novel About a Boy. It's just been adapted into a film starring Hugh Grant and Toni Collette. Hornby is also the author of High Fidelity. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.